The Game Schooler Podcast is a weekly audio show that educates new and experienced gamers about the awesomeness of tabletop gaming. In this week's episode, we'll cover Cargo Noir, our game of the week, discuss why some game stores are failing in the school of gaming, and wrap it up by revealing our high five, high tension games. Welcome to the Game Schooler Podcast. I'm your host, Doug Kotecki, along with my co-host, Dr. Michael McCabe. How's it going, Michael?
What's going on, Doug? How are you?
I am fantastic. I've got not much in the way of follow-up, but I got a ton of awesome stuff to talk about.
Man, both.
Dive in.
I'm just excited. Last week, if this is your first time listening to the Game Schooler Podcast, welcome. He's Doug. I'm Michael. A couple of people who love playing board games, love playing board games with our kids, and if this is your first time, listen to High Five from last week where we talked about relaxing games, because today we're going full contrast. We're going into high tension. So that's my one follow-up. Make sure you listen to last week's High Five before you get into this week's High Five.
And Michael's prep work for today's podcast has led to high tension, so he's on edge. We've had some technical difficulties.
No, that's just
so he's
life stuff, man. Technical
riding
difficulties.
Riding a razor blade.
We're all right. We're all right. We're here. We're set.
All right. What's awesome, Michael?
Well, we probably should have talked offline to get organized a little
bit,
because there's a lot. There you go. Only this hour together and at game night. but we had a board game club kickoff. And you know, year two at the local middle school, attendance low, but that's okay. The people that were there were having a great time. And then the librarian reached out. The director of the library for that school district and said, hey, I'm going to get some titles and I'm going to order them tomorrow. What are some possible games? I thought, you know, that's awesome. So that's one thing that's awesome. I think the thing about when you see people having fun playing games, there are other people that want to support that and help out.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, and I wouldn't say, I mean, I don't know what turnout was last year, but anytime you can get five or six middle school boys to sit around and play some games that are really into sports, not your socially awkward kids coming in. Like, you got a whole bunch of kids coming in to play games. That's pretty cool. So
yeah, that was cool.
I wouldn't be too disappointed. I feel like anything more than four is awesome.
Yeah.
Right? If you got enough to fill up a table, we're doing okay. I wanted to highlight something. This is pretty groundbreaking news, and I think you're going to be excited to hear about it. In the Discord server, Liz found the game of the year at her parents' house. It's the official game of the year. And by game of the year, I mean the people that made the game titled their game the game of the year.
Really?
So you know it's good.
What's the game, Doug? You're killing me.
It's called Game of the Year. That is the name of the game.
Okay.
A company put out a game called the Game of the Year. So I want to applaud them on that for making the Game of the Year. And if you want to know some more details about it, go into the Discord server and check that out, gameschooler.com/Discord. Liz picked up some games from her parents' house that had not been played from when they were kids. And or at all, and brought one of the games she brought home was the Game of the Year.
Sounds like a hidden gem to me.
Yeah, congratulations to them. It's like the world's best cup of coffee. I'm proud of them.
1989, also a very good year. Guess who the artist is on it, though? You didn't look at this too closely.
No, I didn't look at the BGG at all.
Franz Wohlwinkel, the world renowned, one of the top 10 artists in the industry. Game of the Year, though, you spin and move around a calendar, learning about historical events and other players.
Mm.
Guess what it's rated on Board Game Geek, though, on the 10-point scale?
I'm going to say a 5.6.
Ooh, close, Doug. You're out of practice. It's a 4.9.
Okay. I was giving it too much credit.
2 to 6 players, 60 minutes, ages 10 plus. The weight on it, 1.14. Well, looks like we got to get it played now.
Try if you get the chance.
Add that to my want to playlist.
All right. What else is new, Michael? What else is awesome?
Well, you threw me a curveball there, Douglas. Just a lot. We're in spring. I love spring. I'm also a fan of sports, you know, and so a lot of good sports on the television and following teams. And that also takes me into rule books. There's just I never thought I'd be here in my early 40s reading rule books while watching sports, but been perusing through quite a few. Have my queue is filling up nicely of mid to heavyweight Euros that have been on my shelf that are getting dusted off and hopefully getting to the table in this year of 2024. Been playing a ton of games with my kids, Owen, just having fun gaming. How about you?
Yeah. Well, I've got two more things. One, I wanted to continue the what's on my shelf, and the next cube down is a Pegasus Spiel shelf.
Ooh, glad you went down. Otherwise, we'd be at Days of Wonder all the way through July and episode 174.
They don't have that many games. It's only three cubes. And surprisingly, there are quite a few games in this section that we've talked about in the past. So the first one is First Rat, which we talked about in episode 116. And that's a game about a whole bunch of rats that are trying to construct a spaceship to go to the moon that is made out of cheese. And just a really cool couple of different tracks that you can go down, and the way that your rats move and the way you choose to do that. It's a really interesting concept, so I encourage people to check that out in episode 116. The next one we talked about in episode 133, and that's Kazooka, which is a cooperative game about animals trying to get out of the zoo, which incidentally, now that I think about it, could probably be on the highest tension games list later in the list.
I didn't put it the way you and I play it, but for families, it might not be.
Maybe not.
We're getting out of that zoo. Yeah. We are going to Command-Z, Ritcon, whatever language we need to use. Oh, no, we didn't play that well. We're going to get out of the zoo. Back to you, Doug.
I picked a similar game that ended up in my high-tension games, but Kazooka is another one that could be up there. The other one is from episode 58, which is Micro Macro Crime City. I have that and Micro Macro Crime City Full House, and that's a game in which you have a giant map, almost like a Where's Waldo map, and you are looking around trying to solve crimes, and say, for example, a guy was in a building, you can then look on the drawing of the map and kind of see where he was beforehand, trying to find out where people went, where they came from, what they're doing to solve the crimes. Really cool game. One that got brought out during the board game club, so that was cool. And the last one we haven't talked about, we will be talking about in the future, and that's Dorf Romantic, the board game, which is a great cooperative, very relaxing game of casually building a city and then scoring points based on how well you did. So that rounds out the next shelf going down in my game room.
Oh, that's awesome, Doug. That's awesome. You actually inspired me to look at my top left corner of one of my calyxes, and I got some cards out and started sleeving and went down some very interesting rabbit holes that only this hobby can bring. So I'm curious to see how you're motivating and inspiring and creating wonder and awe with our listeners as they walk by their shelves and they think about the games that they already have, right? Going out and consuming the hotness and getting satiated to move on and consume more of the hotness. So that's cool. It's really cool.
All right. And the last thing I want to talk about, Michael, you can cut me off here if you want, but I don't know that we're going to get to this in a game of the week segment. So I wanted to kind of give it some time now, which is the game Aqua.
Why wouldn't that be a game of the week?
Well, I didn't know. It's got some...
Just because I'm colorblind, man? Come on. Now, that's a cool game.
Okay.
I'm not... Well, no. Go ahead.
We'll make it a teaser.
The quick overview of Aqua. All right, tell folks what it is.
I'll give a quick overview, and then we'll make that next week's game of the week. How about that? And we'll talk about
more. No, I'm not agreeing to that, but soon we'll make it a game of the week. Keep going, man.
Well, how many times do we need to play it, Michael? We got it under wraps. We're good. How about we just talk about it now and then I'll cover
leave
it.
Leave it open. I just wasn't ready to commit, Doug. That's all. I wasn't ready to commit. But it's a cool game. Tell people about Aqua.
I didn't put it on your Google Calendar. Aqua, make sure that you write down the biodiversity in the oceans if you're looking that up on BoardGameGeek. Surprisingly, there is two games called Aqua that came out in 2024.
Nobody's surprised about that but you, Doug.
Well, I'm surprised it didn't have woodland creatures in it. But Dan and Tristan Halstead are the designers, and Vincent Dutre did the artwork. And in this game, you are acquiring new parts to your ecosystem, which are represented in little hexagon tiles that you're placing down. Once you happen to, and each of those tiles is divided into two or three different colored ecosystems.
Yeah.
And once you can kind of make a new hexagon out of the different shapes, you add a creature in. You've basically created a habitat for a new creature to come in. When you can get multiple creatures next to each other that are not the same creature, you can get a large creature such as a whale or a narwhal or something and put it on. And those are various shapes and sizes that score you points. And it's an interesting game at the way that the selection of those tiles happens. You can pick a tile, or you can say, I'm going to wait until the end and be the last person to pick, but I'll be the first person to pick next round, which is pretty cool. And then at the end of the game, you score all the small creatures that you brought on board, all the large creatures that you brought on board, and then the large creatures can kind of give you some extra scoring, as well as some reef scoring based on the way that you manipulate some of the colors around the board and stuff. It's a very kind of abstract game that's kind of hard to explain not in person, but yeah. In person you'd be up and running in no time.
Yeah, 2 to 3 minutes. I don't want to do just straight gamer comparisons, but there's two other games that we've talked about on and off. One was Acropolis, which we both absolutely loved and was a game of the week. And another is a game by Emerson Matsuuchi, Reef, that we've talked about and has made a few different lists. And I would say if your family or your friends or your group has enjoyed those two games, Aqua's one that has some similar, I mean, not just theme and mechanisms to those, but you're placing tiles, you're trying to score points, plays fast. It's a ton of replayability, I would think.
Yeah, it's a very tactical game. You kind of need to adapt and move around as you go. I think the reason we're not talking about it more in a bigger segment is I wanted to highlight it as a really cool game, and I really enjoyed it. But, you know, and a lot of times because I'm a horrible person, give Michael some garbage about his color blindness. But this is one that I saw that there were some opportunities that were missed that I think could have made this game easier to handle. And it was hard. And it was one of the first games that I think you and I have played together where I actually saw it come out as we were playing, that there was no kind of workaround for it.
No, there was,
you know, and it was pretty much like, you could only focus on one part of the game, basically. And then everybody could tell you, take this one. The way that it's kind of disconnected is that the colors of the ecosystems match the small creatures that you're adding to your board. However, there's no symbols or anything that makes it clear that those two go together. So if you don't know or can't tell those colors apart, it's really hard to tell which creature goes on there.
Yeah.
And so it was the first game that I saw where it was like, there's no masking going on. Or, you know, I get sometimes it takes a little bit extra processing time to compartmentalize and think, okay, I've got to get this straightened out. And you're awesome at it, which is why it's kind of a rarity that it pops up, is probably why I tease you about it so much, because it's so not an issue in most games that we play.
Well, and I want to separate, you know, my lack of ability to tell pieces apart. And the reason why I'm not quite ready to just say, hey, game of the week next week, I'd like to play this in my house with my family.
Sure.
To see how my own kids take to it.
Yeah.
And when we play a game and I tell them, like, hey, I'm reviewing this for the podcast. The publisher sent along a copy and I really want us to see what you think. It's amazing what will happen, especially if I only do that about two or three times a year. I've gotten better over the 160 episodes. It's not two or three times a week or these three games we're going to play today. But if I make that suggestion to my family, that game will then come up in conversation over the next 5 to 10 days as well.
Yeah.
You know, and people will talk about it. But definitely my wife's going to have to get the rule book, get ready to learn it and teach it, because if I can't tell the colors, it's a terrible teach, man. That thing does not get off the ground.
Well, and it's one that I didn't know if we were going to talk about down the line, but I did want to highlight it as a game that we both enjoyed.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it was
painful for people to play while I'm at the table.
Yes. So if the colors are not an issue to you, it's a great game, and I think people should check it out. And I really enjoyed it for what it was, and it did a really good job of having different scales of variance based on abilities. So you can play a family variant that doesn't have some of the end game scoring, or there's a whole bunch of variety in the end game scoring. So if you are a hardcore gamer and you want to get after it, it's got those levels that I think make it a really cool thing that I wanted to talk about, because sometimes we have games that we play and, you know, they kind of trickle away, or for whatever reason, we don't talk about them. And I just wanted to make sure that we put that out there, that we enjoyed it, we played it, and to check it out.
Yeah, really good game. Thank you to Andrew to the app for sending along a copy. That's good, Doug. Really good. I think we'll come back to that one, but we'll see.
All right. Well, then maybe that'll be the only time we talk about it. Maybe it'll be a tease. We'll see. Hopefully you keep listening in the future and find out. Before we move on, if you're interested in talking to like-minded individuals and sharing what's awesome in gaming, commenting on our high fives and our games of the week, check out our Discord, gameschooler.com/discord. We'd love to have you join in the conversation there. Spread the word about the podcast if you haven't already. Let people know what we're doing. We appreciate that as well. And if you have questions or comments, you want to reach out to us, email at gameschooler.com. Again, email at gameschooler.com. Now let's move on to the game of the week.
The game of the week. The game of the week is an in-depth look at a family-friendly game we think you should try if you get the chance. This week's game is Cargo Noir. Doug, give us the stats.
All right. Published in 2011 by Days of Wonder, and the designer is Serge Léger, which is also the designer of Shadows Over Camelot and Mystery Express. And unfortunately, we lost Serge in 2023. So, and I only bring that up because there may be some reason why some of these games may not come back into print with that type of stuff going on. So the art is by Miguel Coimbra, Cyril Dugin, and 2 to 5 players, about 60 minutes. The box says 8+. Board Game Geek says 10+. I'm going to agree with Board Game Geek on this one. This is going to fall into the family game category for us. In Serge Léger's Cargo Noir, his fourth standalone box game from Days of Wonder, players represent families that traffic in smuggled goods in the 1950s Norse noir setting. Each turn,
Norse or noir? Which one?
Noir. Noirs. all right, where was I? Come on, Michael. Sorry, I'm trying to zoom in on my document here.
I'm so sorry. I just couldn't resist, Doug. Yeah,
no,
a little
Hobbit's,
bit of banter.
I accidentally zoomed out on it, so it was Hobbit-sized, and I couldn't read it. Each turn, you'll set sail to various ports where cargo is known to get lost for the right price. Hong Kong, Bombay, Rotterdam, New York, and more. And you'll make an offer for the goods on display. If another family then offers more in that port, you'll need to up your bid or take your money and sink away to look for goods elsewhere. Stand alone in a port, though, and you'll be able to discreetly move the goods from the dock to your personal warehouse. Once you collect goods, you can trade them in to add more ships to your fleet, allowing you to scout for more wares in more locations, purchase victory spoils, or take other actions. The more goods you collect, the more valuable they can be. The player with the most spoils at the end of the game wins. In Cargo Noir, it's kind of this rolling auction type of mechanisms in which you are sending out your, well, at the beginning, if you are standing alone in the port, you collect the goods in that port. Once you bring all your ships back in, you're going to place ships back out onto the board. Go ahead.
Not to interrupt your teach, but you start with three ships, right?
Correct, yes.
Okay, yep.
Yep, you got three ships, and you send them out to different ports. There are two main ports in the beginning, in the middle of the game board, which is one of them allows you to kind of trade and swap goods in the black market, so you can exchange a good type from your warehouse to what's available in the black market, or you can just draw randomly a random good out of a bag. The other one is a place to collect more money. Why do you need money? Money is what you're putting out with your ships to create a bid on some of the locations around the board that have illicit goods in them. And then when it comes back to your turn, if you have been beaten by another player, so I put two coins down there, and then Michael puts three coins in his ship, I then have a choice to either walk away or increase my bid to four coins. And then on Michael's turn, then he's got that same dilemma. If I walk away, I can't go back to that port in the same round. So, for example, I might collect money from some of the other warehouses and now have enough money to outbid Michael. But I can't go back there if I've already taken my ship off of there. You're collecting goods. There's nine different types of goods, and you are rewarded for either collecting a single type of good, a bunch of those, or individual goods and a smattering of them, which then you turn in. You only have, what, six or seven warehouse spaces to start the game? Six.
Six to start, yep.
So you can hold six goods on your board, and then you can sell those goods to either buy upgrades or victory points, essentially. So a couple of the upgrades is that you can buy more ships. So you can get, instead of placing three out, you can get up to five ships to place out around. You can get a syndicate, which when you back away from an auction, you say, all right, that's too rich for me. You can get coins from that. So it kind of rewards you for walking away or kind of a consolation prize. Or you can get more warehouse space so you can collect some of those bigger sets as the game goes along. What am I missing, Michael? The last thing you can do is you can buy victory point cards like mansions and yachts and things like that. They're straight victory points at the end of the game.
Yeah, you're not missing anything. I think the thing to just say up front, this is a family economic game, which we have not reviewed a ton of those. There's auctioning, there's bidding, there's bluffing, and that exchange of goods. The one thing, I think you said it or mentioned it, but you have to decide when you go to exchange if you're going to collect the same type of goods or different type of goods. So that set collection decision of, am I going to keep all of the same or am I going to go after different?
Yeah.
It is a great little decision space for gamers of all ages. But there's some complexity in that because it's open. Everybody can see what I'm collecting.
Yeah.
So if I'm going after gold and I've got, you know, three gold and man, there's a big difference from if I can get three of the same kind or turn in six of the same kind.
Yeah.
And Doug sees that I'm next up going to collect it. He can put pressure openly and tell the person, don't let Michael get those three gold. Come on, you don't let him win that auction. And so there's that little bit of competitiveness at the table that you only need the third player to set it off.
Yeah. And to give you an idea, some of the nine different types, there's a wild. Every game you're going to throw a number of wild tokens into the draw bag equal to the number of players. There's uranium, gold, jewels, ivory, cigars, cars, art, weapons, and alcohol. Yeah. And all of that is very cartoonly represented. Nothing overtly scary or illicit, as it were.
Nothing overtly. The only thing, it's not the most family-friendly game. So I think the game fits into an era, right? And that era is 2011 Days in Wonder. So there is somebody who's in, you know, near lingerie on there and in the rules. And it's one of those... There are also maybe some tropes or some stereotypes that, you know, certainly would not make it into board games today.
Correct.
That being said, there is an awesome game in there. So I wouldn't, hesitate to play this in my house. But I same thing that when I talked about Las Vegas, the version that I have has a dancer. So I don't take Las Vegas into the middle school game club. So somebody might have to make that decision.
Yeah.
But in terms of game schooling and playing with your friends and family, there's so many things that are in this, either hidden gem or forgotten game. It's not rated very highly on Board Game Geek. And I think when I went in to log my plays and I noticed that, it just made me really think critically about some of the ratings that are in there for older games.
You know,
because I had a great time playing this, and I rate it very, very highly.
Yeah. Well, and as far as the artwork, I don't want it to be misrepresented, because I feel like I look through that. I know you had made a comment of it the last time we had played it. And I think there, from what I can tell, out of the five player boards, there's two of them that have let me put it this way. You can hide this fairly easily if you're, depending on how you're playing.
Yeah, I just think context matters, right, Doug? So somebody who...
It's one of those things. Go to the rule book. Go to Days of Wonders website. Look at the rule book. And right up in the setting up of the game on the very first page, you can see all of the artwork in the game and decide whether that's something that bothers you or not.
A disclaimer I put out there. Somebody who... was a principal, and a teacher. I was very conscious of those things, and a man, right? When I'm taking that into the schoolhouse, you know, and a young educator, not now, but then, I was always conscious of that. So maybe I share those things too much, but I think, you know.
I think it's important, and I think, I mean, it's a game about smuggling goods.
Oh, so fun.
So you already have that, you know, it's about gangs and mafia, but the artwork is a very playful style of artwork, nothing that is grimy or things like that. So with all of those caveats out of the way, what are some of the things that we like the most about that?
Well, I love about the flow of the game. I said this the last time we played it. The first time it didn't really hit me. It was in the repeated plays, and then the very last time that we played, was that just last week?
Yeah.
And we're playing with a friend of ours who plays a ton of games, and there's not a round structure that's similar to other games. It's just a flow. It's like, because at the start of your turn, right, you're going and collecting ships, but you get to decide the order that you do it, and then before your turn ends, you're sending your ships back out, and there's just a very nice little rhythm of, after that first turn, there's a very nice rhythm and steady flow that's different from other games we played, even worker dice placement games and some of those games that have that, that I think try to capture that. The way that you start with three ships, and you can add more ships throughout the game, but you have to actually, you know, consciously and strategically do that, really leads to a nice rhythm.
Yeah, I like the idea of balancing the points and the upgrades. So whether it's the right time to go after some of those upgrades, like an extra ship or more warehouse space and things like that, balancing with going after some heavy points and ignoring those. And that kind of pivot point, and when that happens halfway through the game, is a big component to that. I love the main ports on the main game board, the ability to collect money and or exchange or just draw blindly.
Right.
So it's one of those things, like, you can just send your five ships up there, and you're going to be getting five new goods if you want. You just don't know which ones they're going to be. The other thing with that, with the ports, the way that the game board is a modular board, and based on the number of players, determines how many ports you're opening up, which I think is a really cool thing that usually games nowadays will have a double-sided board, and one board is for 2 to 3 players, and the other one is for 4 to 5 players in which side. But then even then in that regards, like, okay, this is a 2 to 3 player side, but if you're only playing with 2 players, you need to forget that this part of the board exists.
Yeah.
Or vice versa, depending on what board you are. This one, they're tiles that you just flip over, and so there's no kind of unused space. They fill up, and there's no ports there, so you don't fill them up, and they kind of disappear into the background, which I thought was a really cool way that they did this game board that you don't see as much nowadays.
Well, and I would say games that are published from 2020 or 2021 forward through right now, the good ones, they might not ever be done. There's always an expansion. There's another Kickstarter. There's another module. Oh, we've updated this app. We've added this. You got to go get that. Special sleeves. Ooh, we've got this. We've got that. And yeah. What I do enjoy about the games from a different era, and I would put Cargo Noir in that, is that it is a completed game.
Yeah.
You open that up, you're brought into a new world. Everything that you just talked about, the board gets set out, it gets put together. The tokens are little plasticky tokens that might take you to Chuck E. Cheese's or whatever pizza place you think of like that. It's the kid where you get some big prizes. But it's very thematic. Miguel Coimbra's art is awesome. You're brought into this Who Framed Roger Rabbit, but a little bit more modern world. And then the mechanisms, it all just fits together in one nice little package that gives it its own completed experience.
Well, when you talked about too the idea of the ratings being lower on this game than you suspect, I think this is one that is a victim of the time that this game came out. Which, if you think about the time that Days of Wonder published this game, it's coming out around the time, shortly after of a lineage of Ticket to Ride, Memoir 44, Small World. So a great slew of games that had come out before it, and people were maybe expecting something different. So I feel like this game didn't hit because it wasn't what was expected at the time.
Yeah.
And people went into it either with a too serious of an approach of this is going to be a game that we can hunker down and play. And it's like, no, this is a pretty casual game that, you know, is a relaxing kind of auction game with just the right amount of teeth.
How could it take 90 minutes, Doug? It couldn't, right? I mean, that's what Board Game Geek has it listed at. Both of our
players.
Games clocked out at under an hour. Really, though?
Yeah. Now think about it. If you've got five players, not only do you have two extra turns than, say, a three-player game, but also there's
But we'd have to be playing for real money. The only way this is going to take 90 minutes is if I've got real money invested here and real goods. I'm actually getting gold.
But you also have way more ports open.
Yeah,
The variety of where you can actually place is going to be bigger. So some of those decisions on who can I block, where can I get a value, do I really want to pay this much for that, I think is going to increase the competition the more players that you are. And so it is going to lead to more think time.
Okay. Can I jump in on a couple other things I like about it? I talked about it, I bloviated on kind of at the front end, but not just the flow, but there's an anticipation of who's actually going to win the port.
Yeah.
Because what happens when somebody wins a port? Where does that money go, Doug?
Just to the bank.
It's gone. It disappears. And so there are aspects of this game that I think really do lend itself to some of that personal financial literacy. You know, you can only spend it once. And we talked about that a lot, I feel like, in our episodes 40 to 75-ish. I think some of it, that's where we were with our own kids, with teaching our own kids about some of the finer points of money. But the Cargo Noir, with how tight money gets mid-game to end-game, it brought some of that back for me, to the point where we decided it was going to be a game of the week, and I'm still actively pursuing trades. I mean, I'm trying to get this game into my house the same way that I did with, you know, Pirate's Cove was kind of the last one that I played like this, where it's like, oh, it's out of print. When am I really want to be able to have this experience with my kids, with family members, with my kids that bring friends over. Great game that gets up and running. Lots of different skills, and I think very, very replayable, because each time you introduce a new person to that table, the game changes, right?
Yeah. Well, and that's something that you mentioned, is this game currently is out of print. And of course, you know, we always make the point up front to say, try before you buy, try it if you get the chance, type of thing. And this is one, another one we talked about not too long ago, but I feel has that type of thing where this is a game that you're going to find in convention libraries. Yeah. This is one that you're going to find on the shelf, in a demo shelf in a game store, tucked away. And it wouldn't be one that – it's not one that I would be surprised if, because it's poorly ranked on Board Game Geek, that you might be able to find people that are just like, I'm ready to move on from this type of thing.
Well, there's more people that have it for trade than want in trade on Board Game Geek, which is a statistic that – I go to right away when we're looking at an out-of-print game. So I think if you're in a community where a lot of people are playing games, you'll probably come across this at some point.
Yeah.
What are some of the skills that you see in it, though, Doug?
Well, you certainly touched on the resource management, you know, and managing, A, your boats and where they're going, and or the cash and where you're spending, that type of thing. But this is a really good game that I think does two things really well. One of them is observation, which you talked about earlier, watching what the other players are collecting, which ports may be valuable to them compared to you, knowing that they know what ports are valuable to you, especially if you start building a collection of the same type of thing. Like, oh, Doug wants uranium, you know, so that's going to be good for him.
Why? Why does Doug want uranium? That's
don't worry
the better
about
question.
Don't worry about the time machine I'm building. and then the other one I think this does a really good job of is that competition, because it's not in your face. It's not beat you over the head competition. It's rolling in an auction, and it's not.
It's fun.
In a typical auction game where it's like, oh, I bid three, I bid four, you bid five, I'm out, I'll bid six. And it kind of goes, and then it's kind of instant defeat. This can roll around, and the more players that you have, it's like, all right, Michael could outbid me, then Dan outbids Michael, and then I have to decide, okay, now there's like a 3 or 4 coin jump.
Yeah.
I'm out.
So I can get those three goods, but I have no coins, and then my next turn I'm going to have to go find coins, but I can't let him get them. Yeah.
But that competition, I like games where that competition is, I'm not doing this to screw you up. It's because I also want it, and the competition is that I'm just going to put more coins there than you. It's like, you know, it's a subtle, but you're definitely competing over that warehouse and to collect those goods. And so I think it does a good job if you've got kids that are struggling with, I didn't win that one, or because there are little mini victories that are happening throughout the game, and there's enough of them. And there's an equal amount of wins and losses. So it's like, yeah, I may not win this auction here, but I'm going to win another one over there. And so it kind of always balances out. And the game can go along at a clip where you feel like, geez, I'm not winning anything. Or I feel like I'm in a holding pattern. And then all of a sudden you're getting, you know, 3 or 4 warehouses in a row.
Yeah, and there's a great quote on the Board Game Geek page for this. And I just want to take a moment to read that quote. It's from the designer, all right, Doug?
Yeah.
And he said, everything in Cargo Noir grew from a core auction mechanism that is simple and trivial to explain. You can only bid up, and the last bidder standing gets the goods. I love that.
Yeah.
I think that, and even after that auction is gone, there's a sense of, oh, I've got no money, or ha ha ha, he's got no money, they got no money. And then those other goods come out right away.
Yeah.
So there's that fascination of what's next, what's coming out next, that that is built into that auction that I really enjoy.
Well, and how about the idea? So the coins are, I don't know, probably about an inch and a half diameter, and you know, thick. They're little clunky plastic coins, and just the visual of you put your ship on top of it, and it's easy to compare. It's like, no, you got outbid. My ship is taller. Like, yeah. My stack of coins under there is bigger. Get packing.
Really?
You know?
Really? Look, I've got five. You've got five. Unfriendly tie. Go ahead. Put another one on there. Oh, I don't think so. I'm not going into that port after all.
I like that there's a visual representation, because a lot of time there isn't in auction games. It's just, I've got my player shield up. You don't know how much money I have, and I say five, and you're like, I have no idea how close he is to getting to the end. This one, you know.
Yeah.
You know, there's some points where it's like, yeah, there's no way Michael can beat me on this one. I'm going to go high enough because I really want that, or whatever. Like, fine, you want to pay six for it? Go ahead. Like that type of stuff that doesn't happen in a lot of auction games based on different variables.
Yeah.
And certainly a bunch of decision-making in this game as well, for younger players, of where to put your boats out and things like that. Anything else on this one, Michael?
I just have one other note. I want to make sure I say it because we're telling the story of the game here. I love the level of agency, and I talked about decision space earlier, but for collecting ships and bidding, I just think there's something so tactile and also just rewarding for younger gamers and for people who are just newer to the hobby of, yeah, I'm making these decisions. You know, we talk about things that are great in different cooperatives and other different family games, but in terms of just an individual player, I'm in this seedy mob world, but I still know I'm safe just because of the art and some of the things that are in front of me. But I love that level of agency that the player gets at the table, man. I really do. Of all ages.
Yeah.
I think this game just does a fantastic job of putting the player in charge in under an hour. So that's.
Yeah. All right. So that is our game of the week, Cargo Noir. Great game from Days of Wonder. Give it a try if you get the chance. Let's move on to the School of Gaming.
The School of Gaming. In the School of Gaming, we discuss concepts, keywords, etiquette, and helpful ideas in the world of gaming. This week, we're going to discuss, why are some game stores failing? As in closing shop.
Yeah, so this is an interesting one because I think that there's two halves to this coin. And one of them are the idea of kind of amenities and business side, kind of two different parts of this. And let me know what you think, or if you've got any ideas on how you want to approach this one, Michael.
Go.
Okay. So the first one I think of is the game stores. So we've got game stores in our area that are very successful and ones that you can tell are not going to be around very much longer. And one of the biggest differences between the stores that are working and the stores that aren't is what I call like basic amenities of things, which are cleanliness, organization, and friendliness. So these are stores that you're going into and the person seems annoyed when you walk in.
Ugh.
Like that level of like, or they're the employees are playing games in the background and they're mad because you're interrupting their turn to ask them a question.
That would be
that
me.
Type of thing. But then the other one is like organization. And I think all three of these fall under the category of not being friendly to the group that we try and be friendly to, which is new and non-gamers. You know, if you've got an aunt or a grandma walking into a store, like, in being inviting to those people, if you're not inviting to the non-gaming world and outside of people that may just want to are looking for a party game for New Year's Eve, you're going to fall into those pitfalls. Because it's like, yeah, not everybody spends 5 hours a day on Board Game Geek and knows every title that your store is organized like a closet, and you know where they are. But that doesn't help people that don't know anything about games. And the only way that you're going to keep expanding is by getting those other people. Right?
Yeah. No, this is good. Keep going.
This is good.
Well, I was, I was thinking about, there was a teacher when I was first year principal, and when I walked by their room, and I just got like panic, right? Because I mean, like, fish tanks are out. And like that, like there's just stacks of papers upon stacks of papers upon stacks of papers. I'm like, what is going on here? And then, but when I would ask that teacher for a document, it was like a scene straight out of a Hogwarts. Like, just go into a pile and get in the pile and grab the document, right? Whereas another teacher's classroom, I could walk in and I could get the book right off the shelf. I didn't have to ask for permission to enter someone's space. You know what I mean? And I feel like a very simple answer to why some stores are potentially failing are the reasons that we're talking about. A very complicated, but at some points too, it also becomes a very complicated answer. So I know that we have store-friendly local game store owners that listen to our show, and we're not trying to call anyone out specifically or hurt feelings. This question came to us in an email from a longtime listener who was almost sad about some of the stores in their area starting to close up. This question has also populated our Discord from time to time. And then on different, you know, Facebook groups that I'll go to for market research or to try to pick up a game, I've noticed a number of going out of business sales in Wisconsin. A number of over the last year. And sometimes it's really bad, you know, tragic circumstances. If somebody passes away, oh man, I'm really sorry to hear that. But other times you can see people's shop, they're not able to make it.
Yeah.
And so I think there's that just cleanliness, operations, organization side. But what's the other side of the coin, Doug? You alluded to another side of the coin. Go ahead.
So the other side of this is purely on the business side of retail board games.
So like Amazon?
Yeah. So if you think about, you know, 5 or 10 years ago, Target, Barnes & Noble, and Amazon were not carrying Board Game Geek popular games on their store shelves. So if you wanted to get a Ticket to Ride, you had to go to a local game store. If you wanted to get, like, the idea that a Target would stock Everdell 10 years ago would be laughable. Like, they would never carry a game like that. And now those stores are filled with games like that. You can get...
Well, and they make a game of the sales that they run 2 to 3 times a year, right? Now, Target's just coming out of one of their big sales. And on Board Game Geek forums, it's, oh, I've been waiting 6 months to get a Feast of Odin. I can buy this one, that I can buy Feast of Odin, Everdell, and then I get the Wingspan copy for free, and I'm going to trade that to my friend. And you could just see the games that gamers are making. That's very different than, well, I put a hold at my friendly local game store to go down and get Feast of Odin in 2 months after I've saved up enough.
When Walmart is carrying Honey Buzz, you know, there's we are in a different world than when a lot of these game stores may have opened.
Game of the week.
The second thing about it is and these kind of go hand in hand, is the secondary market and the fact that people are able to get some of these games on Amazon, Target, and Barnes & Noble, and they're having these super sales, and then it floods the secondary market, and folks can buy those games for a fraction of the cost when they used to, that than what they used to be, or off of new. that's a huge game changer as well, because there used to be a point where when I first got into the hobby, it was almost this idea of like, well, you hang on to this game because even though I paid $40 for it, you can still get $35 for it used. Like, it's not a bad investment if you don't like it and you want to flip. Like, that's not the case anymore. And I think that secondary market, along with a COVID backlog where everybody was stuck at home and then all of a sudden the thing to do was play board games, and people were acquiring games at an insane rate because they could go through them. Oh, you, Michael's raising his hand. That was him.
Yes, I was, Douglas.
So people were doing that. And then some of those people found out, I don't have the room for this space.
Yeah.
I don't have the time to game anymore. I'm completely getting out of this hobby. So there's that backlog. And then the last back end part of this is inventory management. And when you've got 3,000 to 5,000 new games coming out every year, and as a store owner, you have to decide what's going to be a hit and what's going to be a stinker. And if you guess wrong, you're losing money.
Yeah.
And I think that has become harder than it was before as the hobby has grown in popularity and that more people are making games and there's Kickstarter and all this stuff that you have to keep and keep track of. Of course, Michael and I have talked about just the cult of the new and how the game can have so much buzz and then 3 months later, nobody's talking about it. And as a business owner, how do you buy the correct amount to sell it before the buzz wears off? And if you guessed wrong, you could have 10 copies of a game that you're going to get to a point where you almost have to give them away.
Yeah, and it makes me think that the pressure that's on that friendly local game store is to be a generalist and a specialist at the same time.
Yeah.
Because they have to cover enough of the hotness in the specialty areas within the hobby.
To keep the gamers happy.
The hobby is a large, large tent.
Yeah.
You have all different types of gamers that are going to that friendly local game store. You know, I was having a conversation with the other day with somebody that a friend of mine had connected me with who, you know, this person is very much would seem to be in the hobby, right? They own a board game store. They're doing a lot of different things in the podcast space. But at the end of the day, they play war games. You know what I mean? And that was their thing. They are a war gamer.
Yeah.
And it wasn't that the conversation ended, but right then and there, you could see like, okay, so we have a mutual friend who immediately thought, I'm going to put these two people together. Yet if I'm at a convention, I might not ever sit at the same table as this other person. And where that connects back to the, we're supposed to go to the same market space to get our stuff.
Yeah.
And I just think that challenge, boy, that's a big challenge for a friendly local game store to have to navigate to be able to carry Azul and the right type of Warhammer paint at the same time. Be able to carry the right expansion of Azul so that when I come in the fifth time and want that right expansion, and then, you know, make sure that I also have the right brush to go with the right paint. So there's a lot there.
Well, and then hold enough copies of Ticket to Ride for people that are hearing about it for the first time. You know, and it's like, and I need to have a copy of Old Maid to be able to sell people because that's what, you know, and Monopoly, because that's what people equate with games and that's what they're expecting to find in there if they're not
with puzzles. Gotta have games, puzzles too.
You know, that type of thing.
Yeah.
It's funny you mentioned that you might not sit with that person if you were at a convention. You might not sit with that person if there's 10 people in the room.
Yeah.
Because of the branch in interest, right? And so, yeah.
And then when you're talking about pressure, and now you have to run a business and have enough people to run that business.
Yeah.
And that being a generalist and a specialist, I can't imagine how challenging that would be over time, right?
Yeah.
Because the industry also has an incredible churn rate. There's stuff coming in and out all the time.
Yeah, and then you've got a situation where In order for me to keep my lights on, I've got to sell this game for $60 at full MSRP. And then you say to yourself, but what's stopping you from going down the road to Target and just picking it up for $40?
Yeah.
Because it's on sale. Like that type of thing that was never an issue before. It's like, yeah, you could go to online retailers and save money was the workaround. But now that all the big guys are carrying those same type of games, that's a tough needle to thread for sure. So I do know that the one thing that is keeping those other ones that seem to be doing well goes back to some of the they're managing that business aspect well, but they're also hitting on the amenities and the organization and things like that that make them welcoming stores to non-gamers, which is what I think boosts business over the long haul if you can get those people.
The other thing that I've noticed, and I'll be done here, this is my last comment, but they also seem to have a specialty and they manage that specialty well. We have friends who own game stores, you know, and I don't want to just call them out here without first talking to you about it, but they've shared with us just how they manage their cards, their Pokemon and Magic, their singles. And how they really do that, it's like, man, that terrifies me. You guys really know that market. Noble Knight is a friendly local game store to us. It's located in Madison that, you know, has done different coupons before for the show. They manage used games well. That is a specialty that they have down. And I could go on and on, but I have certain game stores that I like to go to when I'm traveling for work, and they just have all the things that Doug talked about, but then you can also see what their specialty is that continues to bring those regulars back.
Yeah, so those are some of our thoughts on why some local game stores are failing. Let us know in the Discord what you think, if there's anything else that you notice out there. We'd love to hear some feedback on that. Let's move on to, let's bring some tension into the room. Let's go to the high five, high tension games. If you're anything like us, you're constantly on the hunt for new games to try out. This week, we're going to be talking about some games with high tension. Last week, we talked about relaxing games. This is going to be the opposite of that. And to me, there are three different types of categories that tend to lend themselves to high tension. And they are, and maybe it's just two, but the hidden role type of a game tends to have a lot of that, and real-time kind of speed games tend to ramp up the tension for me anyway.
I figure you would lock in on the real-time, so I stayed off of that one just so you could get multiple games.
Incidentally, I only have one.
Okay, well then my honorable mention will cover a few more.
All right.
Only other one I said too is just shared space. So for me, sometimes some of those worker placement I need to get here, or area control, I need to get to that space. How am I going to do it before they do? And then I avoided heavy economic games that I've mentioned in the last 3 to 5 episodes. So some of those I intentionally kept off the list because I've been giving them love. Number five for me was a game of the week, one of two games of the week on my list, and that is Heat Pedal to the Metal from 2022. Days of Wonder getting a lot of love on this episode here, and designed by Asker Harding Granerud and Daniel Skold Peterson. Manage your car's speed to keep from overheating. What ramps up the tension for me is not only am I going to finish and will I finish first, but will I finish so far in first that nobody else will be able to surpass me. There's just an awesome last turn many times in that game, and the tension of an early game spin out where I feel like I'm the biggest loser because I couldn't do basic math. How could I do that? And now I have to catch up. There's multiple layers of tension in that game for me that, similar to what we talked about with Cargo Noir, though, there's a levity to it, that I don't necessarily find in other racing games that have tension. So how can you talk about tension and levity at the same time? Heat Pedal to the Metal does that for me.
All right. Great game. My interesting thing about my list is none of these have we discussed as a game of the week.
I believe that. Yeah.
So I was excited about bringing this list to the table. And my number five falls into slightly into the hidden role type of thing, but not in the social deduction way that you would normally think on the idea of I've got to pretend I'm somebody else or something. And that game is called Grim Masquerade. And in it, you are given a fairy tale character, and you are trying to collect their good cards and not their bad cards. If you get too many of the bad cards, you have to reveal yourself and you're out of the game. If you collect enough of the good cards, you win the game. And so the entire time, and the way that it works is you're drawing cards and then you're giving yourself one and giving one to another player. And there's some other kind of things going on in there. But that tension between, oh, I hope they don't know who I am, or please give me that card, or somebody pulls out a card and they've got the one that is your bad one. It's like, please don't put that in front of me, please. And there's these mini panic attacks that happen throughout the game. I'm like, oh, do not find out that I'm Cinderella. And it's just a really cool game. The artwork is awesome. It's published in 2019 by Druid City Games and Skybound. Tim Eisner, Ben Eisner, and James Hudson are the designers. Not one that gets a lot of love or talk about. It's kind of a sequel to The Grim Forest in the same universe, not necessarily gameplay-wise, but it was one that I got a demo of a long time ago and just instantly fell in love with the simplicity of having that hidden role feel without having to talk my way out of it,
yeah.
Right? So a lot of those hidden role games like Werewolf, and I have the Resistance on my my high five or on my honorable mention. But those where you have to overtly lie and things like that, this one you can slide under the radar, and
it's all
about the card play. So that's
we
my number five.
We play that again with our families again. Sorry, yeah. Doug, didn't mean to cut in. Give the name of that.
Grim Masquerade.
Excellent. Number four for me is the heaviest hobbyist game on my list, Dead Reckoning from John D. Clare. 2022 as well, and AEG is a publisher in Dead Reckoning. Not only are you a pirate, but you are managing a crew with cards out of your hand. It's got that card crafting system, so you can layer up the cards, and they start off with a see-through card and maybe one ability, but then you can add additional abilities to make your crew member, you know, tougher. And the tension in that is, as you're moving around the map, people are lofting cannonballs at you. You will engage in skullduggery. You will have pirate fights. And this is a game counter to what we talked about in Cargo Noir with our game of the week earlier in the episode. This is a game that's never ending. I think they have a Kickstarter that will be coming out every single year from now until I leave this earth. But it is any time that I've played it, there's a tension in it that ramps up. And then once I hit that point of how am I going to make sure that my ship stays afloat and how am I going to upgrade my crew, I'm having to keep track of multiple parts in the game that I really enjoy, and one that I've just talked about with my 14-year-old of getting a saga out. So one that I know is going to hit my table here over the next few months. So there might be a little bit the opposite of recency bias, whatever would be like upcoming gameplay bias, but one that definitely has tension built in it for me when I've played it.
Yeah, it's got a great mix of the area control tension, the don't sink tension of battles, and then
please don't fight me tension. Okay, I'm ready for you to fight me now because I'm loaded.
Yeah. I hope I've drawn the cards that I need, that type of thing. No, great choice there. My number four, I wonder if it's going to be on Michael's list. I'm not sure. And that is The Mind, published in 2018 by Pandasaurus Games and Wolfgang Warsch. This is a game in which you have a hand of cards. The hand of cards is determined by the round you are in. So if you're in round one, you have one card. If you're in round two, each player has two cards. And the goal is to lay the cards down in ascending order without communicating with one another. And the nerve-wracking nature of, I think I have the next card, but it's 20 away, should I lay it down? And everybody's kind of got those alligator arms slowly hesitating, and you're trying to judge by how slow their alligator arms are moving, if you can infer any information on how far away that is. And I've just found that to be quite nerve-wracking. It lands in the same realm for me as like a game like Hanabi that's got hidden information. It's like, I don't want to screw up this for the whole group. It kind of has that guilt mechanism in there. It's like, I've done it. I screwed it up. I'm sorry, everyone. So that's my number four, The Mind.
That's awesome. That's great. Number three for me, I promise, Doug, this will be the last hobby game, but there's a tension in it that I just wanted to share with our listeners, and that's Sid Real Confluence from 2017. Admittedly, I only have one play of this game. I played it at a regional convention in 2023. It plays 4 to 9 players. It is 2 to 3 hours long. Mm. But in Sid Real Confluence, there's basically two different things that you're doing. You're trading, and then you're going to run your engine. And I know I'm really simplifying it down, but you're playing one of 9 alien races, and each race has its own little unique ability, and the abilities all feel overpowered. But the trading of it is wanting to make sure that I'm getting enough value, but I need to also make sure that I actually am able to run my stuff off. And I have not had 3 hours ever pass so quickly in a game experience. And the last few rounds really, really were just in intense. I think the part of what leads to that tension is the time. Say with Dead Reckoning and Sid Real Confluence, the games are longer than an hour. So there's that sense of pace and just engagement throughout. So this is a game that I hope to play with you at some point, Doug. It's a game I will likely never own, and it is a game that I will gladly pay $5 or $6 at a convention to sit down and have that experience. That's my number three, Sid Real Confluence.
I feel like when you talk about a 3-hour game and put it on a high tension games list, I feel like the only thing I'm getting out of it is a stroke at the end.
Well, but I'll push back on that a little bit. We've played a few within the last 6 months that don't feel like they're a 3-hour game.
Okay.
Right? All right?
Because
right?
I can't handle that tension for 3 hours.
Yeah, but it's a pace of it because maybe I'm overselling the tension. No, I'm not. I think that the trading and when other people are then coming in and trading futures and I'll give you that, and I'll give you a blue cube every round. What? So I'll leave it at that.
All right. My number three is a 2-player game, published in 1999 by Cosmos and designer Dr. Rainer Knizia.
Who's he?
That game is Lost Cities. I find this game to be, I love this game, but the tension of trying to complete the expeditions I've gone on, not wanting to give cards that are going to help my opponent, and hoping that I draw the cards that I need is just the... Sometimes tension in a game is bad. This is the best kind of tension that I love this game so much, and I'm surprised that you can get that much out of a 2-player game. One of the best 2-player games of all time. That's Lost Cities, my awesome. Number three.
Awesome. Number two for me, it was a game of the week all the way back in episode 6, and pandemic, but then I expanded that to be the pandemic system. When you have a cooperative with a set defined number of actions and the game is actively working against you and it feels challenging, it feels impossible, but if you get people communicating, you can almost win some of the time. and that, to me, is just something that Matt Leacock got right with Pandemic, the original version from 2008, but then that whole system that has grown out of that, and you see it in so many other games where Pandemic has almost become shorthand for, I have 4 actions and bad things are going to happen after my turn, but then I know my teammates are going to use 25% of their turn to clean up something that just happened on my turn. That I really enjoy that tension at the table. It seems to be my go-to for a cooperative is Pandemic or the pandemic type system.
Awesome. Great game. My number two is the only real-time game on the list, and that is Cuphead, the fast-rolling dice game, published in 2021 by the Op. Games and designer Patrick Marino. Cuphead is you've got dice. You are trying to roll the symbols to defeat the monsters, but you have like 10 or 15 seconds to roll the dice and settle on them and hope that you and your teammates have come up with enough of the correct symbols in order to defeat those enemies. And sometimes it's and the way that it works is you have to roll the dice and then choose to lock some in if you want. And you kind of have to go in order. And once you go past that, you can't lock them in again. And so you're rolling them as fast as you can to try and get the next result you need and hope you don't run out of time. Very stressful, very fun, and great artwork in that one. It's got that 1920s style cartoon artwork, just an awesome feel. And that's my number two, Cuphead, the fast rolling dice game.
Nice. Number one for me is Lords of Waterdeep from 2012. It's a worker placement game set in the Dungeons & Dragons universe, published by Wizards of the Coast, the design team of Peter Lee and Rodney Thompson. And there is just something a little bit, I don't know if I say cutthroat, but there is something challenging about getting into the right spaces at the right time so that the right things can happen. And also when bad things happen to you, it's just how the game is designed. So the tension, there's not a meanness or I just wasted the last 2 hours of my life here. There's just something about that game that brings about that sense of intensity from go with managing the cards and managing the workers. And that's my number one. I had two different games in the number one slot, but why Waterdeep gets it for me, it's the weight. You know, this is more of a light hobby and not a full-fledged hobby game, and I couldn't feel good about putting three hobby games here in the high five. I think about those things, friends. I do. So that's my number one is Lords of Waterdeep, a game that we haven't talked about in a while, and a game that I would love to replay again.
Yeah, I like how your high five is fluid, and who knows what might happen as the
well, wait till you see the honorable mention, Doug. Wait till you see it.
All right. My number one is the one that highlights that hidden role type of thing, and that is a game called Spyfall, published in 2014 by Cryptozoic and Alexander Ushin. In Spyfall, it's got a high player count. I'm not sure, maybe up to 8 players in the original one. And you are passing out cards to each player. And everyone is getting a location except for one person. So all but one person knows what the location is. And you have to try and figure out if you are the spy. It just says spy on there. You have to figure out where you are before the other players figure out that you're a spy. And A, not only is it the tension is so high when you are the spy because you feel like you have neon lights around you and an arrow pointing down that says, I'm the spy. But even when you're not the spy, sometimes the answers that you're giving makes everybody feel, because you don't want to give away exactly where you are. Yeah. So sometimes the answers you give, you inadvertently make yourself sound like the spy, and then you're kind of
trying
like
to backpedal hard and tell people you're not the spy, but then people think that you are the spy because you're backpedaling so hard.
Yeah, and then the wrinkle in this is that you can kind of play two ways, just one with the location, or each location card also has a person on it. And so, for example, if you're in a school, one person might say teacher, one person might say, bus driver, cafeteria worker, you might be the student, one person is the principal. Well, the answers to those questions are very different depending on who you are. And if say, for example, in the school one, if everybody else got an adult and you answer your question based on being a student, everybody else is thinking, what? Like, why is he answering it that way? And you feel like you got a target on your back. And you're like, I'm one of you. Please believe me. And so I just love that tension in that game in a good way. The ones that – so that's my number one, Spyfall. The ones that didn't make my list, Dead of Winter has another element of are you the trader? Are you not? Are you really part of our group? And the game does an excellent job of providing avenues where you're, each person has their own hidden objective, even though they may be on your side, but makes them look like they're doing sketchy things. I'm surprised Power Failure didn't make your list, Michael.
Well, Douglas, I have five on the honorable mention.
Okay, is Power Failure on there?
It is not.
Okay. Whoa. I've got an honorable mention, but that was.
Well,
not
I didn't
on
know
there.
How many you were going to keep rattling through here, brother. Go ahead. What
no,
else?
It's just good. And the last one is Citadels, which is a game in which you pick out a role, and sometimes you're hoping that people don't figure out which role you picked. So.
Yeah, my honorable mention list is organized into categories. The first one is Dexterity. Power Failure, which I'm just adding on my list since Doug mentioned it. Great, great game where you're stacking cubes. It
list.
Was a game of the week. That's how fluid this list is. No, but if you're looking for a solo adventure and you want an intense solo adventure, Dwellings of Eldervale. I've had wonderful tense experiences with that hybrid worker placement where you're chucking some dice, and I've enjoyed that. Two-player, Doug mentioned Lost Cities. Mine is Shot and Totten. I love the Good Doctor's two-player game where you're competing over little tiles on the table and setting with sets of cards. And then real quick, if you've got a group over, Usual Suspects. Great party game. Unusual Suspects, yes. Paolo Mori. If you've got looking for family-friendly tension, real-time, five-minute mystery. We've talked about that one. And then finally, if you've got a bunch of gamers, but they're serious gamers, and they want a tense three-hour slog, Dune Imperium. So that's my honorable mention slash 6 through 12 entries.
All right. Awesome. Well, that is going to do it for us this week. I want to remind everybody to subscribe to the podcast and follow us on X at GameSchoolerU. Don't forget to check out our Discord if you're interested in that, gameschooler.com/Discord. Next week, I've got some notes, but Michael and I probably need to talk about that on air on what we're doing next week. So stay tuned and look forward to that and come back and see what we're doing. But that out of the way, thank you so much for spending the last hour or so with us. We truly appreciate it.
Now get out there and keep gaming.